Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? Derek Evers, Chris Robbins, with the anarchist edition of Nothing Urgent. You're not going to say I'm branding everything now? This is it's the two-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and we're joined today by Greg Fox, musician and drummer extraordinaire, who is in Guardian Alien, goes solo by the name of GDFX, and has been in a litany of other bands.
We're also joined with author Nathan Schneider, who wrote the book Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from an Occupy Apocalypse. The Occupy Apocalypse.
So yeah, it's the two-year anniversary. You were down there today.
I was. It was, you know, a few hundred people, as these things tend to run, and with really perfect weather, too. So, you know, it was kind of sad. It's kind of weird it's been 2 years. There's this guy who came up to a cop in Washington Square Park, and he asked what was going on. Older gentleman. And the cop was like, it's the two-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and they're just here, everything's peaceful, it's fine. And the guy goes, 2 years? Holy shit, has it been that long? And then just sort of like mutters and walks away. And I thought that was a pretty good assessment of, you know.
So was it, for lack of a better term, was it like a shell of its former self? Or
you see the same faces, and the cops will actually know the protesters by name. They'll be like, hey, Phil, like, back off the, you know, back on the sidewalk or whatever. But you don't have the same, there's definitely a sense of like exhaustion to it. To a degree. And when people sort of fall back into these grooves of like the way they protested 2 years ago, it feels a little stale, you know? And obviously so much has changed, like for the worse, arguably, you know? You have all these revelations about the NSA, and the economy is still in the shitter for most American families, and the income inequality gap is still super wide. So in theory, like, it should matter now, but yeah, I don't know. It's definitely... It's strange. The magic in the air isn't what it once was.
Well, this might be some, you know, a reason to bring Nathan in on the conversation. But would you say that it's? I mean, they're more organized now, aren't they? Aren't they like kind of more at a organizational level versus like an anarchist or protest level now?
I would say that their splinter groups are perhaps better organized. But Nathan, what do you think? Like, what, you know, in terms of organization, did that ever really matter?
Yeah. Well, maybe it will matter. It should matter. I think for the moment, the stuff that you're talking about that was so exciting that you're comparing this to, maybe not so much. What mattered was the imagination, you know, like in the book I talk about it as the apocalypse, you know, this sense of unveiling, this sense of, you know, almost like a giant work of art. That's what it was. Now I think people are trying to figure out what to do with that art now that they've taken it in. Now that they've experienced it, and you know, they're splintered all in a billion different directions to try to figure out how to do that.
Right. But haven't we seen like the power of it, or whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it, in a situation like Sandy, where those, you know, the Occupy groups that had organized basically mobilized faster than a lot of the government units did, and you know, agencies, I guess you would call them.
Yeah, that was amazing. That showed up at a moment where everyone was saying it was dead all over, where there were protests kind of like today. Where people were disappointed, and then all of a sudden something happened that really seemed to galvanize people, and that sense of magic came back for a little bit.
I guess this is a good time to bring Greg in.
I have a question about that.
All right.
With the whole Occupy Sandy thing, what actually was the link? Because there were a lot of groups, Occupy this, Occupy that, a lot of different occupations. And when Occupy Sandy happened, I'm curious about... What was the actual link as far as who were the people who were involved with Occupy Wall Street who were involved with Occupy? Were there specific people, or was it like...
It's an interesting story, actually. Like, there was this meeting, right, just before Sandy happened. It was a weekend activist retreat up in the Adirondacks, And I was actually invited. And for some stupid reason that I'll regret for the rest of my life, I didn't go. And but some people I knew went. And they've had a weekend of conversations about what the hell are we going to do next, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, talented organizers. And then as they're driving back down from where they were down to the city, they start seeing tweets about what's happening with Sandy and what's going on there. And then the next day, those were the people who got up and got Occupy Sandy running. There were people kind of strategically placed throughout the movement who'd been gathered together for that meeting. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a happy accident that way. And then others joined in, and then lots of people who hadn't been involved at all before joined in too.
And is that sort of like, I mean, obviously that's a very positive thing that comes from this, but at the heart of like an anarchist movement is kind of this anti, I wouldn't say anti-structure because that's never, but like this more of a...
It's just anti-government.
Leaderless
right.
structure.
And so, you know...
I don't think it's leaderless structure. I think anarchist is just anti-government. I mean, if I understand correctly, the like true political point of anarchism right. is just like no government.
Right. But I think though the General Assembly, which played a huge part in Occupy Wall Street, that was structured around like an old anarchist principle that, you know, money doesn't really matter. It's people and like what they're, you know, everyone got a chance to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the meetings were like 4 or 5 hours long, yeah. and you were like, fuck this, you know, after the first 30 minutes. But it gave people a feeling that they had more of a stake in the process, which I think, you know, it's not like no order. It's not like disorder. They were, to a degree, almost too orderly, right? But I mean, I think the anarchism comes into play when we're talking about there's no one person who's just dictating, or there's right. nothing was really delegated. Everything right. was like totally hashed out a million times over before anything really
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, we've all gotten so stupid about what anarchism is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this sense in which like we think of like people in black with like mohawks or listen to a certain kind of music or whatever. But like a few weeks ago, I was rereading Orwell's account of being in the Spanish Revolution, and he has this these passages where he describes like what Barcelona was like when it was basically under anarchist rule, right? Where the anarchists had actually taken over the city, right? And in a lot of ways, that description would apply perfectly to Occupy Wall Street. You have, you know, the sense in which the whole social order is flattened, where nobody is calling anybody sir, where nobody's tipping, you know, the waiters because everyone's getting a decent wage, and nobody is showing off their wealth because they would be ashamed to if they have it. But that was a city. Like,
right.
I mean, anarchism in history has organized so much, has done so much. The First International had millions of members in the 19th century, right? Organized under anarchist principles. And this idea that the General Assembly equals anarchism, you know, is a product, I think, of a systematic effort, you know, on the part of whoever to erase that memory.
That's
that people cannot actually organize this
right.
way. This isn't crazy.
No, I don't think it is. I think that and that's kind of what I was getting to with my question. Is this perceived apathy, or however you want to, you know, classify as it? Is it something that was basically just, you know, because there's a lot of things, whether it's the media, the way it's being covered, the way that, you know, Bloomberg and Kelly kind of squashed it, whether illegally or however you want to, you know, frame that? Or is it kind of like this faction of within where there are people that want it to be more progressive or more anti-government than what it, that's what I was getting at with the Sandy, you know, comments, whereas like if they're organizing and kind of doing what like the government agencies should do, was there people in Occupy movement that were kind of like obviously not anti helping out people in Sandy, but they were like wanted it to be almost more anarchist than what it was becoming? Is that what bred some of the apathy, do you think?
My perception of it was just that there was a wide spectrum of what people perceived it to be throughout while I was involved in it directly, and that caused it to be cool in a lot of ways, and it also made it sort of chug along in a lot of ways, like you were saying.
I think we should actually clarify. I don't know if I actually said, did we say that Greg, aside from being a musician, the first few weeks, how long were you down there for?
I was there on and off for, I don't really remember that well, but I spent most of my free time when I wasn't on tour there from
I feel like it was a good chunk of the first, like, month or so.
Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, it was definitely a good chunk of the first month, and then I went on tour for a while. I came back, and I kind of tried to reintegrate myself into it as much as was not too difficult to do. And so, I mean, I don't remember exactly how long.
But. And you were helping out primarily in the kitchen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, I was helping in the kitchen, and I was organizing benefit shows.
Do you have any favorite memories? And we'll ask Nathan this question, too. Like, your favorite Zuccotti Park memory?
Yeah, I just, people would just have these, people from, like, all over the country were calling pizza deliveries in to Zuccotti. And, like, we would have to spend a huge amount of effort and manpower delegating who would receive those deliveries and then pass out. We were just handing out pizza all day. I mean, it was amazing. You know, like, not just, like, plain pizza, too.
Right.
It's, like, the whole, like, whatever kind of... People could, like, be like, I'm not going to take this plain slice. I'm going to wait for pepperoni to come around. I mean, really, like, talk about,
the
like, an ideal.
Yeah, the food was really good.
Yeah, it was great.
Now we can thank Greg for that.
Well, no, you can't, but...
The food was very good.
Yeah.
People ate well there. What about you, Nathan? Do you have a particular favorite moment?
Well, there were so many. The ones that really stand out for me are just... Are these moments of personal transformation where someone would come up to me... in the park at one point and tell me they thought this was screwed up, this was dumb, you know, that everything needed to change this way. And then a week later, they'd come up to me and they'd say, oh, now I get it. Now I get why we're doing it this way. You know, this makes sense to me. And in the process, they'd kind of shed this, like, horrible shell that we carry in terms of our political identities about whether we're a Democrat or a Republican or what leader is going to do what. And that's really exciting to see people, like, reimagine themselves as political actors all of a sudden because they've been hanging out eating this guy's pizza.
That kind of reminds me of just another thing similarly, which is that, you know, kind of like at the steps to Zuccotti Park along, what was that, Broadway or whatever?
Yeah.
You know, the sort of main entrance, the main sort of congregating area. People would kind of come and sort of see what was going on. And some people were like, you know, thought that they were opposed to Occupy Wall Street and would come there to, like, get into debates with people who were sort of standing at the sort of rim of it. And I remember being privy to a lot of conversations that started as, like, heated arguments that ended up with people realizing that they just kind of wanted the same thing. And it, that was very interesting to sort of, like, watch people's sort of, like, thoughts about their political identity kind of just, like, dissolve and realize that they don't really know how they identify.
That's kind of the, you know, American political machine in a nutshell.
Right.
I mean, the red versus blue is basically just trying to, you know, strike your fears against one another versus actually, you know, when we're all kind of in the same class or whatever.
It's also really a classic New York thing to, like, argue with someone when you essentially agree about it, you know?
Everyone wants
it. And they need pizza together after.
Yeah. Right. I like the cigarette rolling table. That was one of my favorite things. And then...
Was it for other people? Or
it was for anyone who wanted it.
That was something that I noticed from when I first started going to the planning meetings before Occupy Wall Street began. I was like, shit, these people smoke a lot. I've never seen so many, like, young people smoking so much. It was amazing.
But it was, like, no questions
and
asked.
And all hand-rolled.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It was, like, four people. It was, like, an assembly line, literally.
It's like when you go to San Gennaro and they're rolling
it's too bad the e-cig thing had
those. And also, at the beginning, too, this was a moment where, like, there were not the drugs that would show up later, right? I remember one point being in a tent with a bunch of people on the first night when there were tents during the first week, and someone gets out, like, a flask of vodka or whatever, and everyone's like, put that away. Who cares about that? You know,
right.
we don't need that. You know, there was this kind of Puritanism of it, but that didn't apply at all to chain smoking.
Yeah.
Well, that was probably something that they were, you know, I think also at heart of it is, like, you don't want to screw it up where you're going to give them a reason to kick you
and
out.
And you can do that anywhere else, you know, like, Zuccotti Park is, like, this little sliver of freedom. You can get drunk anywhere else in New York City.
Oh, no, but another thing, too, is that, like, I went up to another one of these retreats with a bunch of occupiers to this place in Vermont, a former kind of old 60s commune, right, where they take people. So this was like the Occupy year when they brought up the occupiers. And normally at this commune, the thing is to skinny dip, to strip naked, you know, go in the hot tub naked. That's what you do at this place. And this was the first year when nobody did that. And, like, the people...
Was it self-imposed, or was that...
Yeah. The Occupy people were just like, we don't really want to do that. And so that was, like, that left these, like, 60s folks, like,
What? They should have done
it. Is it with you people?
They totally should have done it.
Yeah, shattering the nude paradigm.
You can keep the conversation going in the hot tub with all your clothes off.
Yeah. I remember the one time I went to Sweden on summer solstice, and that was when they went swimming at midnight, apparently, and they all did it naked. And I was like, I did it. But it did feel, as an American, I'm also, we don't need to get into that.
We need to get into Derek's body issues.
Yeah.
Or do we?
Yeah. Well, they have...
As a microcosm of America's body issues.
That's right. That would actually be very apropos.
I wanted to... So, when the false eviction happened, and everyone was in the park, and everyone thought the cops were going to come in... Yeah.
There were two, right?
Well, yeah. So, the false one. When they were the park's being cleaned at 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to get out. It ran up to the last minute, and then there was an announcement that they weren't going to kick everyone out. And there was just crazy blind euphoria, and that really freaked me out because I had never seen anything like that before in my life. And I there was definitely a moment where I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And then I as someone who is supposedly reporting on it, you also have to maintain a degree of skepticism about it. So I want to ask Nathan, was there ever a point where you were like, I'm in this too deep, for lack of a better term, I'm biting the hook too hard, and was that ever a concern, or was that ever could you cover it better in that sense, or how do you report on something with charges of you're one of them, or
totally it was agonizing, especially at the beginning. I got on one of the big NPR shows in New York, and the first thing the guy who I've been listening to for years asked me are you a protester or a reporter, and I'm stumbling, stuttering, whatever. And because by that point, this movement had taken hold of me in a way. I came as a reporter. I introduced myself as a reporter when I went to the first meeting. This was actually recently depicted in the newsroom based on my Harper's article. But I show up at this meeting and say, hi, I'm here to report on this. And people, and they say, no, cops are reporters. And then they have a debate about me, and then they finally let me stay. So from the very beginning, my position there was fraught, and something about this movement calls one to shed your professional trappings, to be a person and to step out of the bounds that society normally places you in. And, for me, I was especially susceptible to that because being a journalist is kind of a trick I do in order to have an excuse to interview people and write about them. So I was, it was easily shed. Others held on to that a bit better than I did. But, ultimately, in certain circumstances, I found myself just throwing away the notebook entirely and organizing some things myself. But most of the time, I thought that, I could do the most good by writing about it.
Right.
Can I go back to something for a second?
Of course.
Please.
So the whole... Maybe I don't know if I'm actually going back to something, but this is just something I kind of thought about in the course of the past couple minutes of conversation. I think one of the things about Occupy was this whole issue of the public space. When you brought up the whole people in a tent, somebody brings out some vodka, it's like, no, don't, you know what I mean? We don't have this thing that a lot of other countries have, which is the freedom to gather in public space and drink alcohol. And I'm not arguing for that because it would be fun to drink alcohol in public. I'm arguing for it because I think that that actually is something that stops people from getting together and getting into what's going on.
Well, I'd venture to say that most of our rules of whether it's public intoxication or things in public in general are probably geared exactly towards that, to kind of suppress things before they may or may
not
happen.
Someone came up to me today because the cops and Brookfield Security, the Brookfield owns the place where Zuccotti Park is sitting on, and they were saying, they had barricaded the whole park and they weren't letting people take in cardboard or signs, or just they made up all these bullshit arbitrary rules that they can't really legally enforce because it's a public space, right? They took the tax break, therefore they have to allow these things to happen, but they weren't. And so this guy who had been in Egypt, who'd been in the Middle East and covered really hairy stuff, was like, these people, they're bitching about these barricades, they need to go to Cairo or whatever. And I was like, no, that's not the point. We're not in Cairo. We're in fucking America. We're in New York City. We live here, so we don't have to deal with the barricades.
We go to wars for our freedoms.
Right. So, right. It's totally a matter of perspective, right?
Yeah.
Yes, barricades don't sound that bad compared to tear gas or compared to the other things. The stuff that was going on in Oakland. still, though, I think the point is still relevant. It's like, that's, that ain't America, if I could use a contraction.
Well, there's the way in which, like, just having people come together in a park for a while, like, why was that so magical? Why did that feel so weird? I think it's because we're not normally able to do that, you know, in this way. You're able to gather together if you're all appreciating the same entertainment at the same time.
And you have a permit.
Or there's nowhere else where, like, religion is like a mass exercise of earnestness, but there was like very little secular outlet for like earnestness. Well, I had never seen many earnest people in the same place.
We've lost
it. That's what's fucking scary, you know? And that's, as like a skeptical human being, you're like, whoa, like this is like religion. But at the same time, it's beautiful because it's not religion. It's like just a shared belief.
You see that in other countries, though. I mean, I've been lucky enough to go, my work has taken me on tour and throughout Europe especially. And I've been, I mean, you know, you play a lot of like squats, like anarchist spots, you know what I mean? And those people, they put on like rad shows and people get totally twisted and party all night, but then they feed people and they do all this amazing local politics stuff. And you see, I was in Milan on May Day this year, and the night before my band played, and it was like just like a total raging party. And then the next day we came back and they had tables set up and they were feeding probably hundreds of people free food. And they were the youngest people there were probably, you know, we're toddlers, and the oldest people there were very old, 90s, I don't know, old people. And people started singing these protest songs, and everybody knew the words, you know? And it's not like that here.
No.
It's just not like
that.
You know,
but people talk about the failures of Occupy a lot. You know, one of them I recognize, I was on the way to the West Bank for a trip last year and passed through Tel Aviv, and stopped in a bar that had been set up by the movement there, right? You know, they had a tent movement in 2011, too. And in that bar, the bartenders are members of the co-op. You know, everybody, you know, it's all organized according to movement principles and so forth. And, like, everybody's there at that bar scheming about what to do next. And, like, Occupy Wall Street, for all that it did, it still hasn't come out with a bar. You know, like, that to me
that's
is the biggest
idea.
Failure.
That's a really,
like,
good idea.
You gotta have a space to congregate and have these discussions, and a bar is a pretty good way to do it, and you should run as a co-op, and it'll be great.
Yeah, and if people want to drink, let them, because some people get comfortable that way, you know, and that's how they can participate. Whether that's a good or bad thing, I'm not going to judge.
Well, it's just interesting that you guys bring up that whole concept, because we, you know, I think the biggest... one of the biggest frauds we're told, and it's like this is turning into an anarchist issue right here, I think, an anarchist episode. But one of the biggest issues that I think we're free, and that we have all these freedoms. And then this comes right to the heart of it, because you look at all of the times throughout history, especially in the last 50 years, when there's been large movements, whether it's civil rights, whether it's Kent State, whether it's Occupy, they eventually just were there's a great deal of force that, like, if we see it happening in Egypt or something like that, or Syria, we're like, oh, that's, you know, that's not something we would do. But in essence, like, we have less of those types of movements, because I think it's part apathy, and I think it's part ingrained in us that, like, you know, we shouldn't do those things. It's not the proper or behavioral way that we're supposed to do, when in actuality, freedoms, or however you wanna
our lack of freedom is a lot more subtle.
It is.
It's a lot more subtle, and it's like more it's more calculated, maybe. I don't want to go full paranoid, but I mean, I am.
The tinfoil hat edition of
I like to say. Well, someone else has got to chime in here, because I just forgot.
Well,
what
it's
kind of.
I mean, if you look at it, if you compare it to, like, you know, your friends in Europe, there, like, it's actually quite clear. I mean, when they look at the U.S., they're like, "That's really fucked up," and here's why. Try to form a union in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know. And see what happens.
Try to even have a public meal and feed people and see what
happens.
Absolutely.
And cities across the country right now are making that illegal, even for, like, church groups, right? And you know, every effort to organize and to create structures that give people the impression that organizing together as ordinary people is a way of building power get immediately ruthlessly suppressed in subtle and not so subtle ways,
sure.
Right? And then we're told, oh, unions are bad for you anyway, so don't worry about it. Right. But in Europe, like, when those May Day parties happen, like, it's because they have massive, powerful unions that can shut down the country if they want to.
Well, I remember being in France and, like, being amazed that they were allowed to have giant parades for the Communist Party, like, just rolling through the streets. And it was, you know, to me, that was like, you know, and this is one of the, you know, major powers. This is our ally in basically every war we go to. And meanwhile, they have a giant Communist Party that still is very active there.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite interesting.
Well, I mean, the U.S. is huge, right? And, you know, think about the fact that, like, 5% of Americans, I don't know if that's actually accurate, but somebody told me this, but it's probably close, that, like, 5% of Americans have passports. Some very small amount of Americans actually leave the country and travel to other countries, you know? So, like, the average American, which is such a, like, loose term to use.
Yeah.
Who is the average American? I don't know. But, like, the vast majority of Americans don't have a really, you know, hands-on sense of what culture is like throughout the world. They only know about it through the news, and mostly TV news. So when you go to Europe or something, and the people there, they are neighbors with other countries very close nearby, and they have a very clear historical sense of what's going on because they've experienced it or their parents experienced it. So their political, their views and their political, you know, activism to whatever length that goes is based on, like, a hard reality. Whereas it's so abstracted here to the point of a matter of, like, deciding what kind of person you are and what kind of clothing you buy. And then now, okay, well, where is my political... It's just such a cloud of, I think, disorganization.
Yeah, and I think that has a lot to do with the generational thing. The fact that, like, we might have more in common with our grandparents, you know, versus, like, our parents. Because our parents grew up in a time that was very... You know, America was at its most wealthy and prosperous. So, like, that also judges, you know, like, clouds your view.
Well, I think that point about the international stuff is so important. And, you know, one thing that the media in the U.S. always missed, even, like, the left or radical media, was that, like, everyone in those early planning meetings before the occupation who were trying to do this and who put their bodies on the line for it, they weren't talking about America. They were talking about the Spanish. They were talking about the Egyptians. You know, some of them had been in Barcelona and Madrid and Cairo over the past year, and that's what they were thinking about, and that's who they were communicating with too. And they thought of themselves not as another American movement that was trying to take over America. That's part of why they weren't interested in addressing Barack Obama or whatever. You know, they saw themselves as being like the Americans trying to finally pick up the slack of what the rest of the world was doing that year.
So we've been spending the last however many minutes talking about what Occupy was. We're gonna take a quick break. We're going to play a little Guardian Alien.
Some palate cleansing.
Yes.
Palate cleansing Guardian Alien.
A little palate cleansing. And then when we come back, I kind of want to talk about what we should expect moving forward.
Okay.
And what, you know, what today is kind of about versus you know, what the last 2 years has been. Is that okay with you guys?
That's fine.
Yeah. No.
All right.
Just trying to be contrarian.
So this is See the World Given to a One Love Entity, Part 1 by Guardian Alien. We'll be right back. So that was part one. Apparently, it's about how long in reality?
That was just a part.
That was just a segment.
That's from the record is called "See the World Given to a One Love Entity," and it's one track, which is 34 or 35 minutes.
Is
long.
That considered an EP or an LP?
I consider it an LP.
Yeah, it was a long play.
Yeah.
Well, Thrill Jockey put it out, and apparently the man at Thrill Jockey made you cut it down into segments.
Well, you know, you got to play the game if you're gonna, at a certain point, there's a bottom line.
Oh,
how long? Wait, hold on.
That's not very occupied.
Well, how long was it supposed
to
be?
Yeah, no, it isn't.
How long did you want it to be initially?
No, I wanted it to fit on a record.
Okay.
So,
all right.
There you go. Gotta sell some units.
All right, yeah, that's fair. Gotta move those units.
This was a couple years ago. My thinking has changed a little
sure.
since then. But I'm still, I like this record, whatever.
No, it's a great record. And you are,
you should pirate it.
as Nathan said, he was like, "You're the drummer on this?" And I think he followed it with, "Holy shit," or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much that's what most people say when they hear you drum.
You can curse on internet radio,
you
too.
Can.
Do whatever you want.
Until the FCC comes hammering down on us. But not today, because this is anarchist episode.
Occupy's future. Obviously, not obviously, but there have been other marches since, you know, between now and when Occupy was generally considered quote-unquote dead. Like the Trayvon Martin march that happened back in July was pretty moving, and that didn't really have much to do with Occupy. But in terms of, like, direct action, I feel that Occupy's moment has passed. So, like, where do you guys see the movement seeping in to, like, viable fields to create social change, I guess would be the phrase, if anyone wants to take a stab at that. I mean, obviously, Occupy Sandy was a big deal, but, you know, and there will probably be another Sandy or another natural disaster. But, I mean, like, in terms of influencing policy. I mean, I think Occupy's done a really good job. Then again, I mean, income inequality, it's not like, hey, we fixed it, you know, we can dust our hands off. I mean, it's still a huge issue. So, I mean, do we keep hammering away at that issue, or is there perhaps another way of getting at the heart of the matter, or like what?
Yeah, I think I just did an article for The Nation called Breaking Up with Occupy, right? In a profile,
very good.
Two people who are in the process of kind of coming to terms with the passage of this thing from the present to the past. And I think that's, you know, in a lot of ways a kind of important thing. I'm not saying it's the only way it has to happen, but I think people on some level have to move from the experience of what was so cool there to an experience that's different and that is also cool and that will build power. You know, that will build organizations, and there's just no substitute for that on some level. And that doesn't mean giving up the ideals of the movement. You know, as I was talking about with Barcelona and the Spanish Revolution or whatever.
Well, okay, in the parlance of our horrible social media times, does this mean that Occupy has to rebrand itself? Because a lot of people
Occupy will. I mean, sorry,
you know what I mean? Like people are like, we don't need to call it Occupy, like fuck Occupy.
I mean, Occupy
as a brand.
Occupy,
you know?
In quotes, whatever Occupy is, has been rebranding itself since the dawn of political dissent.
Okay.
I mean, it's just like a new name for the same thing.
Okay.
And the cool thing is, for a lot of people, it was their first realization of a political identity, which is awesome. I mean, that is why it had its value, and that is the cool thing about it. So the two things to take away from it are, one, finding other places to put that energy politically and publicly in a community way. I mean, Occupy Disaster Relief is a great thing, and I'm sure they'll do a better job forever than FEMA. But there are a number of other public arenas in which it makes sense to put that energy, you know. But then I think also, on the other hand, it's about work you do on yourself. You know, it's not just about, like, it's not just about, like, being at a protest or, like, being politically active in that way. It's also about, like, trying to improve yourself and, like, face yourself and do work on yourself. I think if you can, like, actively turn a lot of that energy inwards and, like, try to improve your inward situation, you'll be more of service to the world, and that makes you more able to act politically and socially.
Okay. And then another old person question, which I think it still matters, but in the beginning, you know, of Occupy, people were like, why don't they just vote? Like, where, you know, where they vote. They need to be part of the process. And as, like, you know, out of, to me, that sort of misses the point. At the same time, votes are what matter at the end of the day, unfortunately, in the process that we have. How much does that need to be? I mean, do you think Occupy didn't utilize that enough, or was that besides the point? Or do you think the future will have to have that component as a better sort of part?
Yeah, but it all depends. It's not just about voting or not voting. It's about who's voting and voting for whom, right? And, you know, a friend, Mark Bray, just wrote a book called Translating Anarchism, which is a study, really in-depth study of the political perspectives of the main organizers in Occupy Wall Street. Did a great job. And one thing he pointed out is you know, actually a lot fewer of them voted for Obama in 2012 than in 2008, even though I think they contributed to his victory. But what he did say is that for a lot of these people, whether they voted or not, you know, a lot of them did vote. But that wasn't the point. What they were more interested in is the politics of the rest of the year, you know, the rest of the year. And I think that's what matters. That's what we've got to focus on. And if you look at any cool campaign that's going on around the country right now, you have people in it who are involved in Occupy. I mean, you look at the fast food workers who are organizing, you look at the Walmart workers who are organizing, you look at the people who are putting their bodies in the way, the Keystone XL pipeline running through the middle of this country, planning, you know, fixing to destroy the earth, you know, all this stuff. People occupying the Florida State House you know, these are people who were involved in Occupy, who often met each other through Occupy, got activated, and, you know, now they're on to doing, you know, great work in other fields and having an impact in those fields.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, to take the positive spin, because I feel like we've been, you know, you were kind of a little bit dismissive, but, like, you know, is that also because of the, you know, again, I don't want to call it apathy, but the way we perceive it is like, oh, it's the shell of its former self. But at the same time, a lot of things you're mentioning, it's kind of almost more ingrained into kind of like our perception of how we should be looking at things. And, I mean, this is a very, you know, loose way of looking at it, but even just here in New York, the way that basically we've gotten kind of tired of the Bloomberg regime, and I'm not saying that's because of Occupy, but I think some of those ideals is kind of like, well, some of them struck a chord with most people, not just the people who were down there, and I think it slowly starts to seep into our consciousness, whereas, like, you know, that made a lot of sense.
I guess the theory is if you help people, you know, recover from a disaster or do something good for someone else, like, that will bleed over into your political persuasion, right? Then you'll start to make perhaps more informed choices elsewhere.
Yeah, but I think we have to get out of this. I mean, I totally agree with you about the need to do inner work and personal work, but I do think that has to be done, you know, in conjunction with people around us. Like, do that inner work while getting to know your neighbors and getting to know their concerns and their needs, especially, like, we're in fucking Bushwick. Like, let's talk to our neighbors who, you know, if you're moving into Bushwick, talk to the people who've been there for decades. Talk to them about what they're interested in, what they're concerned about, and what they do, how they have fun. You know, be a good neighbor. That sort of thing. That's pretty basic. Suddenly, you'll find yourself getting politically radicalized real quick, you know, because they're having, you know, basically colonization happening to them. You know, and the same thing happened, I think, with de Blasio. The role of Occupy in his election is very clear. I mean, he made a gamble, basically, right, that by running a commercial showing his children, who are people of color, he wouldn't alienate his white base, right? That was the gamble that he made. And by highlighting Stop and Frisk, a basically racial issue, you know, Bloomberg called him a racist for doing that, right? But I think it was because of Occupy that a lot of white people in this city who would otherwise be blissfully ignorant of stop and frisk policies, you know, raise your hand, we're a group of white guys, raise your hand if you knew about stop and frisk before Occupy.
I was stop and frisk.
I was going to say, or if you've been stop and frisk.
So that's, yeah. One, yeah, that's one out of three, right? And after Occupy, we all know about it.
Right.
No, well, also the tale of two cities. I mean, that's such a blatantly obvious message of income inequality.
But I think what Nathan's saying is true to the point. It's like, it's almost like we see, like, the march, but the march, or you know, whether it's the rallies or whatever, but it's almost like they don't need to be in that capacity to the same extent anymore, because it is, you know, like you brought up Trayvon Martin and, like, de Blasio and things where I just think it's almost, I don't know, we get used to, like, you know, say 4, 6, 7, 8 years ago when Bush was running things, we kind of became so, like, depressed and kind of just well, I guess it would have to be past 6 years ago for it to be Bush. But you know, it just kind of became the norm. And to put, like I said, to put a positive spin on it, the norm has sort of become to think critically and socially a little bit earlier than we might have in the past. And I think that's something that we do owe at least a little bit to Occupy, if not to, you know, the gaping economic inequality in this country.
Yeah, which is still a problem, though, you know? There's, like, there's something to be said for simplicity. And I feel like that's why the whole 99% message was so good, because it was, like, a super politicized sort of slogan, right? It's simple, and everyone's a part of it, right? You know, and I'm the 99%, you know, you're the 99%. But, like, does it need to be that simple, though? I mean, Occupy was never that simple, but should it be more simple?
I think it was, that slogan was off by a single percentage point.
It was like 98%.
No, we're the 100%. I mean, that's this, like, idea that there's, like, two different groups or any... I mean, it's like, we know that there are this, like, there, we know for a fact that there are, like, ultra super wealthy people who are, like, making decisions that are purely about their wealth getting greater, which are at, you know, at odds with the well-being of huge populations of people. You know, I'm generalizing, but
yeah, no, I think you're right.
But this is something we know, right? But those people are still people. You know what I mean? And, like, whether or not they're, like, on our side or not, I mean, we all, at the end of the day, you know what I'm saying? We all come into this world the same way, and we all go out the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I like to use
that's a really holistic way of
looking at it. Well, I like to use the 10% theory, and that my assumption or my theory is that 10% of every demographic is going to be corrupt. And 90% of them, I mean, that might be off or whatever, but 90% of them are going to be generally good. And it's just that when 10% of, like, the super wealthy are corrupt, that has a huge effect on everyone else. Whereas, like, you know, the 10% that may be, you know, ripping off the welfare system is probably not going to really hurt
10%
us
of
that
rodeo
much.
Clowns ruining everything for everyone.
For all the others.
These fucking corrupt rodeo clowns. No, I know.
But that's, yeah, so that goes back to the point Greg was making. We can't villainize everyone, and I think that's something that, but at the same time, I think that's something that the 1% or whatever you like to fall back on. I see a lot of message boards where it's like, well, if you just worked harder, you know, and I think that's where it gets clouded.
I think politically going forward, I think the important thing is to organize. I personally just think the most important issue is economic reform worldwide. I think that's the most important thing, and I think that when it comes to putting your energy politically into something, there are a lot of different places to put it. My place of putting it would be, you know, advocating for economic reform.
And the Koch brothers agree with you that is the most important issue, which is why they're dumping hundreds of millions of dollars into this secret bank that they just reported on like a week or two ago. So it's like this whole other shell game that no one knew existed that they're a huge part of. And they're, like, doubling down, you know, they won in Wisconsin, essentially. Florida, how did Florida pan out? I don't even know. Like, they're still fighting. Anyway, North Carolina is the same way.
You're talking
about
the workers' rights.
I'm talking about collective bargaining rights, yeah, which is, like, used to be a sort of baseline, hey, everyone has the right to collectively bargain for their, you know what I mean?
Right.
That, to me, like, we know what the Koch brothers are going to do, right? We know what that, if I may, that 1%, we know what they're going to do. It's just a question of, like, what everyone else is going to do and how they're going to, like, properly allocate resources to fight it. And, I mean, maybe fighting's a poor analogy because you're right. It is, like, it alienates that 1% of the population. And also is, like, it's too glib. I mean, that's just too simplistic. But, like, politics are simplistic, and politics are glib.
Because then with that kind of rhetoric, you get into this idea where, like, oh, well, if that 1% wasn't here, then everything would be okay. And that's bullshit.
No, and, you know, Bloomberg says it all the time, and he's a dick for saying it. But he's like, that's the tax base. We can't piss off the tax base. And it's like, you know, he has a point in that, yes, like, the 1% subsidizes a lot of taxes here and makes our, you know, lives possible in New York City. At the same time, you know, the pendulum can swing too far in that direction, which is what's happening.
Well, I think that's ultimately also the give and take of politics, is that it swings to one side and then it has to swing back the other. And, like, you know, to use de Blasio as an example, I hope he wins. I got into a discussion with someone who was very pro de Blasio, and he's like, I think he'll probably end up being looked back on history as, like, the guy that ruined the city. But ultimately, for 4 years or 10 years or whatever, I mean, you know how we look back.
Okay, right,
but,
sure.
But for that amount of time, our tax dollars will be going to things like education and healthcare, whereas for the last, you know, 10, 12 years they've been going to Fresh Direct, you know, opening up, you know,
yeah,
you know, whatever. So I do think that there is a point to everything you say. I do want to ask you guys one question before we get going. We focus a lot on New York, but you brought up Oakland as I mean, that was obviously like kind of one of the more hot spots in terms of I mean, violence.
Yeah.
I don't know how you want to look, how else you want to...
Clashes between the authorities and protesters.
And for a certain extent over the last 2 years, I feel like they were getting a little bit more attention than New York has been. Were they celebrating? Was there something going on?
I think it was a global
Oakland
celebration, but, you know, not on the scale of New York. Because, again, this idea, the old Occupy was about Zuccotti, right? And that magic in the air. So this was more of like a wake for the magic. And then the main event is presumably going to be less harder to like pin down, less simple than that park, you know? But yeah, I don't think so. Not to the degree that
I think more people were celebrating the release of Grand Theft Auto 5 today.
Which is
probably very carefully timed.
Well,
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Grand Theft Auto V.
Which celebrates anarchy to the utmost, right? I mean, it's just like there's no rules.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. They spent $250 million in that game. I read that this afternoon. I was taking a break.
That game?
They spent $250 million just to make it.
They're going
to
make a shitload more than that.
Yeah, well,
property
I don't know.
Is theft. Just remember that.
Well, if it taught me anything, I should break into a store, steal it, so I can play it at my own leisure. Isn't that what they do on Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, I get what you're doing. I get what you're doing. I laughed inside.
Is this thing on? Well, guys, Greg, Nathan, I want to thank you both for taking the time. I know this is a topic that I wish the world would talk about more, and I think it's something that, you know, we can't let go away just because, you know, at the heart of it, it's what, as musicians, as authors, as journalists, I think it's kind of what we're about. It's like what you said. You go into it with the notion of wanting to be an author so you could talk to people that you want to kind of be close to. I know that's why I got into music writing. And I think that's something that we need to take from all of this is that, you know.
Yeah, just pay more attention to this stuff. Pay more attention to people trying to organize themselves. It matters.
And
it's beautiful.
And keep having the conversation.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, conversation's half the battle, right? Talking to people.
I know I'm having a hard time having a conversation right now.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you again, Nathan. Thank you again, Greg.
Good night.
Until next week.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.